Panna versus Kraft Foods. Thielen.
May it please the court, good morning. Michael Steigman on behalf of the plaintiffs. Your honors, let's dive right into the pretext argument here and what happened with Mr. Pena and Diaz when they attempted to apply for the technician jobs. It's undisputed for purposes of summary judgment that they were qualified for these positions. The trial court found so in its order, and it hasn't been disputed by Kraft. For purposes of summary judgment, it's undisputed that they attempted to apply for these jobs and that their supervisor rejected them, did not let them apply. It's also undisputed that two people outside of the protected class were hired for these jobs instead.
Could you expand just a bit on the second of those points, in what way the record will show that they attempted to apply? Are you relying on the summer effort when they were told no, come back, or how did they attempt to apply?
In September, they went to Mr. Mihalik and said, we want to apply for these jobs. He was the person in charge of collecting the candidate pool for these jobs. And Mr. Mihalik said, you cannot apply for these jobs. That was the testimony of Mr. Pena and Mr. Diaz. That was the basis of them going to HR shortly thereafter and saying, Mr. Mihalik didn't let us apply for these jobs. We want a chance to apply for these jobs. We want these jobs. So that is in the record.
They had previously applied
in July for these exact same jobs. 2 months later, the outsourcing is announced, and these jobs open up again.
The July thing got canceled, right, because the outsourcing was to come, I guess.
Correct. And so they applied before. Now they learn they're about to lose their jobs as well. Of course they're going to apply to save their jobs, get the promotion, try and stay with Kraft. And they go to Mr. Mihalik as soon as they find out the jobs are open again, and they testify Mr. Mihalik does not let them apply for the jobs. Now, given this undisputed, for purposes of summary judgment, Kraft has not come up with a legitimate, non-discriminatory reason why Mr. Mihalik did not let them apply for these jobs. And therefore, under the indirect method or the direct method, Kraft loses. They are not entitled to summary judgment if they cannot come up with a legitimate, non-discriminatory reason Mr. Mihalik refused to let these two individuals apply for these jobs. Now, it's true that after the jobs had been awarded to two other individuals and the plaintiffs complained to HR, that HR later comes up with this imaginary, hypothetical, after-the-fact comparison and not surprisingly says that, well, the two guys who got the jobs, everybody was qualified, but we think the two guys who got the jobs were a little more qualified than you. Now, under Seventh Circuit law, that analysis is completely irrelevant. That was not part of the analysis of the application process. The plaintiffs were not part of the application pool. They weren't allowed to be in it. And I think the closest case to compare this to might be Rudin versus Lincoln Land College, where because of the strict application of the defendant's affirmative action policies, the plaintiff never really had a chance. And later before the court, Lincoln Land tries to argue, well, yeah, he didn't really have a chance because of our policies, but it turns out we hired the person who we think had the best qualifications. The court said, no, you can't do that. It's what happened at the time. You know, of course, after the fact, HR is going to say, well, you know, the plaintiffs had better experience, better training in the area. The guys who got the jobs, well, they had more mechanical skills. We think the mechanical skills are more important. Of course, HR is going to come up with some reason every time after the fact for this imaginary hypothetical, but that's irrelevant. That's not a pretext analysis. That's a try-and-cover-your-behind analysis after the jobs have already been awarded to other individuals.
So you said in passing whether it was direct or indirect, but if you're really focusing on pretext, that makes me think that you're really relying more heavily at the moment on indirect method of proof. You preserve both.
We have preserved both, and there are some similarities in both here, but...
I mean, Mr. Mihalik made all these various statements, but perhaps the indirect method is the one. I mean, there's a lot of law that says you don't look at after-the-fact events.
Correct, Your Honor. And you know, we have provided numerous evidence under the direct method as well. We feel we can triumph under the direct method, too. And, you know, focusing also on what HR did after this, Kraft's VP for Human Resources, Mr. Conte, tells the plaintiffs after his investigation that they weren't hired because they did a comparison of qualifications, and that's why the plaintiffs didn't get the job. That was a lie. That was not true. The plaintiffs were never part of the applicant pool. They were never even considered. And Mr. Conte just lied to the plaintiffs about that. And defendants admit that in their answer to the complaint in paragraph 100. And, you know, this is part of the shifting explanations.
In paragraph 100 that Mr. Conte lied, or just that this was said?
They admit that he told the plaintiffs that they didn't get these jobs because of a comparison of qualifications.
But your position is taking the facts as they assert them to be at the application stage. That can't be.
But no, they didn't get the job because they were never considered. A different pool of eight candidates were considered. Their qualifications were looked at.
That a different pool, why the pool was those other eight people, I guess, may be the point of contention.
Well, the reason why the plaintiffs didn't get the job is because they didn't apply for it. That is the only reason. I mean, they weren't allowed to apply for it or they weren't in the application pool. The reason.
Like this is one of those cases. It reminds me a little bit of Hopkins, but it's one of the cases where there's an exclusion from an opportunity. I mean, we don't know at the end what if the application pool had been 10 people instead of 8 or whatever, what would have happened, but. Sounds to me like your theory for this is what I said, an exclusion from an opportunity.
Oh, that's correct. They went to the person who was accepting applications, who was their supervisor. They said that we want to apply for these jobs, and he said, no, you can't.
Right.
He said,
well,
no, you can't.
Remember, at Hopkins, it was the opportunity to become a partner. Nobody knew whether she would have or not, but it was the opportunity, yeah.
That's correct, Your Honor. And, you know, it's difficult to think of an explanation other than discrimination why Mr. Mihalik wouldn't at least let these people apply for their jobs, apply for these open positions when they're about to lose their jobs anyway. And, you know, it raises an inference here. What is going on? Why is Mr. Mihalik presumably lying about this, considering the plaintiffs applied for these same jobs 2 months before and now found out they're losing their jobs and somehow they don't apply again? I think the plaintiff's story here that Mr. Mihalik denied them the opportunity is much more reasonable than any alternative explanation, and that's why Kraft has so much difficulty coming up with a legitimate, non-discriminatory reason why the plaintiffs weren't allowed to apply for these positions. And for purposes of summary judgment, the plaintiff's testimony has to be accepted here, that they weren't allowed to apply for these positions. Mr. Mihalik prevented them for no reason, apparently, other than discriminatory motive. And, you know, as the trial court correctly found, Mr. Mihalik, there was testimony that Mr. Mihalik admitted discrimination against another Hispanic, Ms. Flores, at the same time, which is admissible evidence under...
So your position is that this exchange with Flores, where she testifies that he's talking about Matt Simon, he's white just like him, and he has a family, that that's of some evidentiary value the Pena and Diaz?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. The trial court even agreed with that, and I believe the Hassan case confirmed that comments to other members of the protected class can help show discrimination against individuals in that same protected class when an adverse employment action occurs.
Did the district court actually take into account that evidence as to the conversation between Flores and Mihalik?
Yes, it did. It said
in consideration of Pena and Diaz's claims?
Yes, it did. It said in a footnote that while it wasn't dispositive of the other plaintiff's claims, it could be considered among the other evidence presented by Mr. Diaz.
But did the court ever come back to evaluate that in the equation when the court actually ruled on those? I didn't see any further
It didn't comment further on its evaluation, mostly because of, you know, this token exception doctrine we explained in our briefs, where, you know, the court finds, you know, three Hispanics are discriminated against, but if one Hispanic doesn't suffer the same discrimination, then you can throw out that evidence. And we argue that that's not Seventh Circuit law. That
it's actually an inverted form of the comparator thing for a plaintiff to make out a prima facie case. The plaintiff often has to point to somebody else who's similar in all respects except the protected category. But I'm not familiar with any law that says a defendant gets to say, I didn't discriminate because I'm sometimes nice to people in the protected class.
No, and the law we cited says that that is totally improper. The case of Bell specifically allows the use of statistics. And, you know, statistics mean that there's some percentage of people who haven't suffered the discrimination, but a greater percentage has. And
actually, the Supreme Court has explicitly disapproved that line in both on Cal and also Castaneda against Partita, where it has said just because people are of the same, I'll just say, broadly protected category doesn't mean that discrimination couldn't be happening.
I agree, Ron. I think we cited the Fernco case, too, where, you know, you don't look at certain percentages. And, you know, maybe Hispanics are 15% of the United States, but that doesn't mean you can limit the Hispanics at Kraft or, you know, plant on the west side to 15% of the employees. You know, it's just any discrimination against a protected class, if the discriminatory motive is there, has to be acted on. It's illegal. The court's token exception doctrine has no basis in the law whatsoever. And that was one of the court's main errors. And the other one...
Before you run out of time, I'd like you to address Mr. Robles' claim.
Yes, Your Honor. One of Craftsman's arguments is that he didn't have any admissible evidence that he was performing at grade 3. We have his own supervisor saying he was performing in that level.
But their argument is the performance is important. What I was fascinated by, or I just want to nail down, is I thought you were arguing that the actual job posting for which he was originally hired described the position as a grade 3, and he was told, well, we're going to pay you at 2 for a while, but you'll move up to 3. And if the job posting really shows it's a 3, then under Kraft's position, he should be a 3, because they say the grade goes with the position, not with the individual.
Oh, that's so absolutely correct. We agree with that.
What's your evidence of what the job posting said?
The job posting lists, as you said, a grade 3 on it.
Do you have that piece of paper or something in the record?
Yes, it's Exhibit P, Your Honor. It's plaintiff's Exhibit P.
Okay.
It is in the record. It does show a grade 3 on it. And the supervisor said, this is grade 3 work. You don't have really enough experience to justify you starting you out at this salary. After you've been at the job a while, you'll have the necessary experience. You'll have been able to show you do a good job. We'll give you that promotion that you deserve for doing the grade 3 work. That complies with Kraft's internal staffing procedures. The supervisor was well aware of what work Mr. Robles was doing. And I'll reserve the balance of my time unless there are more questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Christy Fantavong, and I represent the defendant appellee, Kraft Foods Global, Inc. The issue before the court is whether District Court Judge Ronald Guzman properly entered summary judgment in favor of Kraft on all of appellant's claims. Because appellants are unable to create a genuine issue of material fact under either the direct or the indirect methods, summary judgment should be affirmed. I'll go directly, Your Honors, to the issue relating to whether or not it is automatically sufficient to withstand summary judgment that Supervisor Michalek refused to allow Diaz and Pena to apply for the senior technician positions. Your Honor, Supervisor Michalek denies this. Of course, the summary judgment we accept as true, the plaintiff's contention that he refused to allow them to apply. This argument is not sufficient to withstand summary judgment under either method of proof for several reasons. I will note first that there is no reason, and plaintiffs have offered none, that they couldn't have gone to someone other than Michalek to see whether or not they could apply for the position. They say he refused to allow them to do that. even under the summer posting, Appellant Pena had gone to an HR person and expressed his interest that way. He knew how to do it. He could have done it. He didn't do it here.
I thought it was uncontested, though, that McCulloch was their supervisor, was, that they would be bound to follow his instructions.
They can say that, Your Honor. They simply said he refused to allow them to apply. They haven't said that they tried to go to HR before the positions were awarded and apply.
He's the decision maker here, though. I thought that was also uncontested.
He's the decision maker along with his decisions being approved by his own supervisor, and HR was involved in the selection process as well.
Right. But, I mean, it's critical that he's the decision maker because otherwise whatever bias may infect his thinking, we'd have a more elaborate analysis to go through.
Certainly. And I think the issue here is whether appellants are correct that the simple fact that he didn't allow them to apply, according to them, is sufficient to withstand summary judgment.
But I don't think they're making an isolated fact argument. Their argument includes the tangible evidence of their interest from the summer application. Their argument includes the evidence that what might have been motivating him, a jury could find, was bias, not I don't feel like looking at two more applications or some random thought from all of their evidence, whether it's the comment made to Ms. Flores or whether it's the other evidence in the record. So it's not just a simple fact case. I think you might be oversimplifying.
Well, I think what they're trying to say is that he didn't allow them to apply, and for that reason, they ought to withstand summary judgment.
Because there's also evidence in the record. That's the job action part of their case. The other evidence that they've presented is the motivation for that job action.
Absolutely. Absolutely, Your Honor. And their case falls apart there. There is evidence that the process that he did follow, even assuming that he said, you too cannot apply, the process that Supervisor Michalek followed was working through HR, putting up a posting. He put the posting on a bulletin board for everyone to see. He obtained all the applications. He worked through HR. He interviewed all those people. There is nothing about that process which excludes Hispanic employees in any way.
Unless he instructs two people not to apply. I mean, I guess that's maybe we have to decide where we jump in the pool here because that's, I think, the problem here. And
it's his disregard of the normal process that's the evidence of discrimination here in connection with all of the surrounding circumstantial evidence.
And there is no policy that they can point to which suggests that everyone who's interested in a position needs to be allowed to apply. So there was no specific policy that was violated. It may seem that if someone's interested, you should let them apply. There may be reasons not to allow someone to apply or not to consider that person. Magulak had worked with these people for years. Perhaps if he actually denied them the right to apply, it was because he had worked with them for years. He knew that they would not be people that he would have selected.
And surely that's a jury question, right? I mean, they would have their evidence of the bias on national origin grounds. He would have, I assessed them and I just didn't think they were going to be competitive, and a jury would decide which account to believe.
Except there needs to be evidence in the record that they were clearly better qualified. That's what this Hobbs decision teaches.
Now, that's only if they're in the pool. I mean, we don't know how their relative. People are never exactly the same. So that's why I said I think the focus here is on the denial of an opportunity, not the denial of the job. If it were denial of the job point, then you'd be exactly right. I mean, we have law that says we don't lightly override an employer's assessment.
There are Seventh Circuit cases, however, where a denial of an opportunity was involved, and this court went straight to pretext and qualifications with respect to the selection for the actual position.
But that was ex ante qualifications. That's not, at the end of the day, when you kept somebody out of school, looking back and saying, we never would let you in.
It is, though. In Hobbs, the plaintiff was never considered for the position. The city, without following the normal process, hired an acting foreman for a position, did not consider the plaintiff whatsoever.
But that was because the city had a practice of very frequently moving people from the acting position up to the real position. It was acting consistently with a longstanding system.
The actual initial decision was putting someone into that acting position in the first place.
I remember.
And so she was not in that female plaintiff was not even considered for the acting position, acting foreman position. This court did not stop the analysis there. Instead, continued the analysis, looked at pretext with respect to the selection itself, and that's what should be done here.
The practice here, the undisputed practice here, is open posting. Open posting for vacant positions so everybody can apply, as I understand the record. So it's very different from that case.
The policy is that positions would be posted and made available to people. There is nothing that says everyone who is interested will necessarily be interviewed.
What's your scenario and how the denial happened? How do you...
Could I come up with a theory as to why he would have denied them? It's as I said before, Your Honor, for he had been working with these people for many, many years, the people who received the positions, the people who didn't receive the positions. He knew what their abilities were. Even appellants Diaz and Pena testified that their mechanical abilities consisted of working on cars with their friends and family in their spare time. When mechanical abilities were something that he was very focused on, and he knows that there are people available who have been specifically trained, have been performing mechanical jobs for years, perhaps at that point there's a reason to say, you know what, don't even bother.
Yeah, but the fact that you're using the word perhaps illustrates that this is all a matter of supposition, and what we have as a matter of undisputed fact is that there's a longstanding practice of open posting for these vacancies, and that the supervisor of these two plaintiffs specifically told them they couldn't apply when there was an open posting.
He told two people that they couldn't apply.
Right.
He did not tell Hispanic employees that they could not apply.
I understand that, but he told these two Hispanic employees that they could not apply, and then we have all of the other surrounding circumstances of ethnic animus.
We don't, though, Your Honor, and I think that's something where...
Well, that's a different question. If you're going to contest that,
right, and we certainly do contest that. Your Honor has said that there are all these other things going on that show animus. They aren't, and they fall apart at every step of the way. All of these comments that appellants have put in the record, there's either no foundation for them, or they're not race related, or they have no connection with adverse actions at issue.
And what about the exchange between? Is it Michalik? Is that how it's pronounced?
Michalik? I say Michalik.
Michalik and Flores.
Yes.
Which is contemporaneous to the job actions at issue here.
And it's contemporaneous with, I shouldn't even say contemporaneous, but that has to do with the sanitation positions, not the senior technician positions, just to be clear. But what actually happened in the record, according to Ms. Flores, is that after the sanitation positions were awarded, she was unhappy that she was on the night shift and not the day shift. And so she went to Michalik and said, can't I move to the day shift? Can't you put me on the day shift instead? And according to her, he then said, my friend Matt Simeon, he's white like me, and he has family that can't take care of. That comment shouldn't even be given any weight, and this isn't a question of fact. It shouldn't be given weight, our position is, because she contradicted herself during her own deposition.
But there's no rule that says you only allow evidence at summary judgment when the deponent doesn't contradict herself. People contradict themselves constantly. Those are jury issues. She says that he said he's white. And there is indirect evidence here. I mean, I'm disturbed at Kraft's stressing that Mr. Fernandez got certain jobs and that Ms. Flores at least got the night shift, because there is, in fact, no rule that says as soon as you've treated one member of a protected class well, you get to discriminate against all the rest. That's the whole point of requiring intentional discrimination. That's the protection on the other side for companies. Inadvertent or negligence or all sorts of other things are not good enough. But if you're intentionally discriminating, that's against the law.
Certainly, Your Honor, we are not claiming that there is some kind of token exception rule. Appellants heavily emphasize that the district court created some kind of token exception rule. Our position is that the district court did no such thing and that it's not necessary here.
But we did keep saying, well, because Mr. Fernandez got things, there couldn't have been discrimination against Hispanics. And that just doesn't follow.
The category of evidence that evidence was raised in had to do, under the direct method, the circumstantial evidence relating to systematically better treatment of non-Hispanic employees. When a court is analyzing systematically better treatment, it does make sense to look at all of the treatment. Can we say, when we look at everything going on, that there is systematically better treatment of non-Hispanic employees? The treatment of Fernandez is just one part here that makes that fall apart. There's also evidence than non-Hispanic employees, and Hispanic employees were treated similarly with respect to Michael Lick's treatment generally. The evidence in the record is that he followed everyone around. He disciplined everyone.
He seems like a thoroughly unpleasant person, actually. But
and that may be the case, but it's not discrimination, Your Honor, and that's important.
I understand that.
And so it falls apart.
What about the working outside? You know, it seems to me that there's evidence that it's only the three Hispanic employees who were put out for this undesirable work.
The evidence in the record is actually, according to one of the impellants himself, that Peter Michalek worked outside. They could barely keep him from doing it.
I mean, they're told they're doing it all the time.
He was out there. Appellant Robles testified he loved it. Michalek loved it. You couldn't keep him out there. You had to drag him away. That's what his testimony was. There was testimony that a coworker, Dee Hunt, was out there as well. Appellants can't contradict her personal testimony about what she herself did in her work. Additionally, there's no evidence in the record that shows that working outside is an adverse action. It doesn't. It's not undesirable.
No one's saying it's an adverse employment action. That's different. Can you speak for a moment about this exhibit with respect to Mr. Robles, that the job description for the position that he held, Exhibit B,
absolutely,
was a grade 3?
Yes, Your Honor. This is going back to 2001 when the posting for a salary grade 3 technologist was put up. At that point, Appellant Robles was interviewed for the position. He was told that he did not have the qualifications to be considered a salary grade employee, a salary grade 3 employee. He was specifically told, while this was posted as salary grade 3, we are not going to give you a salary grade 3 position.
Doesn't that completely contradict everything that you said in your brief about positions being evaluated at certain grades, not individuals?
He was not given a salary grade 3 technologist position at that time.
Position, well, what did he get then? Because your brief is very insistent about that.
Mm-hmm. He was given a salary grade 2 senior technician position. And that's the work that he did. He seems to believe that because milk processing, which is what his particular responsibilities were, milk processing is a hard job. I've been doing it for a long time.
No, I think he thinks that he was hired in a grade 3 position, but they didn't want to bump his salary up to that level until he had a little experience in job.
It's not about salary. He's received merit increases. It's about a salary grade, and he was not performing responsibilities of a salary grade 3 position.
What's the evidence? When somebody is hired at the plant, in any job, just forget about these people, there's a posting. The posting apparently classifies the job at a certain grade. And then is there some master company record that shows the job for which each individual of the company was hired and at which grade it was?
Your Honor, there would be records, for example, yearly performance reviews would write down what the person's salary grade and position was.
Okay, but is there like an employee file on each person that says, you hold the post of XYZ, which has been rated by Kraft as a grade 4, or is a grade 2, or is a grade 3?
Yes, there would be internal records that show that he was holding a salary grade 2 position, and those records do exist. He testified he held a salary grade 2 position. He just thinks that he should have been promoted into a salary grade 3 position over time as he had developed the kind of experience and qualifications that are necessary. A salary grade 3 position, for example, when you're talking about these technician positions, requires the ability to supervise others and to not be being supervised by yourself. Deuce, on whom appellants rely, first of all, they say he's a supervisor. There's no evidence in the record that Deuce was a supervisor. He was a coworker. Deuce said he didn't know what level that he was at, and Deuce said that Appellant Robles didn't have the ability to supervise others. He had to be supervised, which is a salary grade 2 type of position. I see that my time has expired. May I have a brief moment to conclude?
Yes.
Your Honor, the facts here are not actually at issue. There aren't questions of fact that are material fact for the record. Instead, there is simply no evidence of discriminatory intent here, and appellants are unable to meet their burden under either the direct method or the indirect method of proof, and summary judgment should be affirmed.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You have 2 minutes, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Getting back to Mr. Robles, Mr. Deuce, in his testimony, and I believe his affidavit, says he was Mr. Robles' supervisor. that Mr. Robles was doing grade 3 work, and the only reason that he didn't start out at this grade 3 salary for the work he was doing was because he was building up his qualifications and experience. And as soon as that happened, he promised Mr. Robles the raise for the work he was doing, the grade 3 work.
But what would you do about the fact that apparently there's a book somewhere that's carrying Mr. Robles as a salary grade 2 employee? I don't know if such thing is in the record or what. I don't know.
We're just requesting that Kraft follow its internal procedures that if an employee is doing grade 3 work, that they're paid a grade 3 salary. That's their internal procedures. We believe we've raised the inference from Mr. Mihalik's other actions here that the reason that Kraft has not followed this internal procedure, as verified by Robles' own supervisor and that job posting, which was Exhibit P as in Paul,
sorry.
No problem, that he had a discriminatory motive and intent.
Who hired him for that position?
I believe it was Deuce himself, was his original supervisor, and said, you're doing grade 3 work here, but right now we want some more qualifications before we can pay you the grade 3 salary. Get some experience. You'll get those qualifications, then we can pay you at grade 3.
Is this then in the nature of a failure to promote?
That's correct.
Claim?
That's correct. That's
not
Mr. Robles' claim.
That's not how it was conceptualized at the EEOC level. It was a disparate pay claim there.
Well, he thinks he's doing the job, so it's kind of both, maybe, I think, might be the quick answer.
How was it argued in the district court?
That he should be paid under Kraft's internal procedures, he should be paid at grade 3 because he's doing grade 3 work.
So it was conceptualized as a disparate pay or a failure to promote claim?
I think disparate pay, that because he was doing grade 3 work, other people were doing grade 3 work, that Kraft pays people who are doing grade 3 work, grade 3 pay. He was not being paid grade 3 pay for doing grade 3 work.
But now it's being conceptualized as a failure to promote to grade 3? Claim? It's kind of in a moving target.
You know, obviously we have to rely on what was argued before the trial court, and I don't know exactly which one it was. But I think either way, frankly, if he's doing grade 3 work and Kraft requires grade 3 pay, then he should be paid according to the grade 3, like we've argued. Is there any more questions?
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.